KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
Hello and welcome to the Hour of Hope. I'm Pastor Matthew over here in Accutan, Safe Harbor Church. I'm so glad you're with me. Hey, shout out to our main listener, Vera. On today's program, you're going to get to hear a very special guest, Vince Spady. He's out visiting us from the mainland. He's been here a couple weeks. It's been a delight to have him and his wife. And I thought, oh, you should hear some of his great stories and some Bible thoughts. And I think you're going to be blessed. I begin to listen to him. I'm like, oh, that just sounds like NPR Bible show. So I think you're going to love it. But let's pray first, and then let's get right into it and prepare yourself. It'll be great. Lord, thank you for this time. Bless it. Pray for all those that are listening that would be encouraged. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Without further ado, let me bring you Vince.
Hello, everybody. This is Vince Spady speaking to you from Accutan, Alaska, out here in the Aleutians, not too far from Dutch Harbor. My wife is Mary Lil Spady. Both of us, though we're visiting here for 3 weeks this time here at the church with the Romans, we currently live over in Soldotna, Alaska, just out of the Kenai area there on the peninsula, where we've been for the last 40-some years. We think it's... Before I get started, I just want to say I never imagined that I would have the opportunity to share with people on the radio. I think to myself, I'm just a regular guy, not a radio guy, but here I am with the opportunity to share with you. Now, I've always been an adventurous guy and told lots of stories to all my friends and things like that, what's going on, but this is definitely a first time on the radio, so pardon me any mess-ups that I make here. I want to say that my wife and I, we have been in Alaska for 53 years now. And of course, living here that long, you're bound to develop your own stories, your own adventures to share. Everybody's got your stories, so here's a chance to hear some of ours. My friends and my family, they're always saying me, my kids will say, Dad, you need to write a book. Or my friends say, you need to write a book. Well, that'll probably never happen. I want to begin with my first hunting story. I think that's just a kind of a fun place to start. Mary Lil and I arrived in Sleetmute, Alaska to teach school on August, not sure what day, but in 1972. And Sleetmute is located up on the Kuskokwim River, kind of between, about halfway between Bethel and McGrath. It's a small village of about 100 native people there. And Mary Lil and I came as school teachers. Mary Lowell was to teach first, second, third, and I was going to teach fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth. No, oh, I'm getting off here. I don't want to get ahead of myself. We weren't there but about a week, and some fellows, the natives there, asked me if I would like to go moose hunting with them. And I said, well, I'd really like to go, and that sounds fun. They said, you got a rifle? And I said, yeah, I've got a rifle. They said, what kind of rifle you got? And I says, well, it's a 30-06, and they go, oh, good gun, good gun. So that Saturday morning, after the first few days of school, we started the day after Labor Day, I got in the boat with a couple friends, and away we went up the Holitna River, a Clearwater tributary that comes in right at Sleetmute, and what a great day it was. I took my shotgun with me. Shot a lot of good eaten ducks, good mallards and pintails. It wasn't long. We stopped on the Holitna, and I pulled out my fishing rod I'd taken along, and I caught a couple great big grayling. One was 18 inches, and the other one was almost 21. And the guy with me said, that's the biggest grayling he'd ever seen. And so I thought, well, that was fun. And then on the way back, there was a big bull moose standing on the banks, and I was able to shoot him, even though he ran out in the water after I shot him, and we had to practically cut him up. We tried to pull him out of the water, but it was too big and the antlers kept getting stuck in the gravel. But so that was just a great start to living in Alaska. We weren't, just sharing about the same time frame, we weren't there very long, and we had our first major survival story, just kind of bumped forward a couple months into October, and it was getting late October, and the weather had been getting really cold. It had gotten down to 20 below there several nights in a row, and there was lots of ice running on the river, these great big thick ice pans, some of them as big as a house, and pretty soon there was more ice covering the river than the than there was open water. One of our friends became our friends, the dental assistant from public health, his name was John White, and a dental assistant, I'm drawing a blank on her, Helmy David, or Davis was her name, and they came up and worked on all, set up a clinic in our kitchen in our apartment attached to the school, and we're fixing all the kids' teeth, and then the people in the village, their teeth as well. It was about their third day of being there, and the family that lives across river and up about a mile invited them to come to dinner. So they went up there early, about 1 p.m, and Mary Lou and I followed about a little after 3 when school was out. So we had a nice evening of dinner, and of course we didn't get out of there until around 10 o'clock at night. It was time to come home. And Mary Lou and I had gone up in our little boat. It was about a 12-foot boat with a 7.5 horse, fast enough to go up against the current and get us there. What got interesting is when it was time to come home, John asked if he and Helmy could ride home with us. And I says, boy, our boat's pretty small for that. And there everybody's saying, oh, it'll be okay, just take it easy. And so in the dark, we loaded 4 of us into that boat. And Nixie, whose house we were staying at, his sister says, well, here, you better take a flashlight to shine so you can see the ice and Stubby between the ice. So Mary Lou sat in the front with this big, long police flashlight that held about 5 or 6 of those big D batteries. And it was a pretty bright light shining. I could easily see to steer between the ice. And we were working our way across the river. And apparently, the boat, a little bit of water kept splashing on Mary Lou in that front seat, and then John and Helmy were in the middle seat, and I was in the back seat running the motor and steering. So Mary Lou moved to the middle seat, so there were 3 there, and apparently that was maybe letting more water come in over the back if we weren't sitting level anymore or what, but we don't know for sure. But all of a sudden Mary Lou yells, Vince, there's water coming in. And all 4 of us stood up and pushed that boat just right down under the water. And all 4 of us were swimming in the dark, 20 below, out in the middle of a river, mostly covered with ice. Well, we could barely tell where we were and which way to go, and we started swimming towards the shore, at least most of us. Helmy Davy was holding my arm because she couldn't swim. And we worked our way toward... kept working our way toward the shore, and we talked to each other. Mary Lou said, everybody here, we're doing okay, keep going. And she shined the flashlight ahead of us and on us. And we finally got to where we could crawl up on the ice and get out of the water. And we stepped up, and I says, oh, there's one problem I see. And I see that the trees over there, I could see the tops of the trees and the little bit of light, and they were moving toward our right, which meant we were still floating downstream. So we had to walk across that big piece of ice, get back in the water, and swim some more. And, well, the Lord saw us through that. We finally got to where I could stand up, and then we walked, and I had to break about 10 yards of real thin ice that was too thin for us to climb up on before we got to some stronger ice where I could climb out on. Well, all of us climbed out, cold as we were, and walked down into the village. The first couple houses, no one was home, so we kept walking. Finally came to Peter Zakar's house, and he says, oh, come on in. And he cooked up his stove real fast and even got his little Coleman stove going. They all lived in a little one-room house, he and 3 kids sleeping on the floor. So he did go down and get us some dry clothes at the school where we lived. And so God saw us through that very first night, which very easily could have ended with all of us not surviving. But little Sleepy is a village with about 100 people in it, and our classroom was just an old BIA school built, I think, 1937, I think, but I'm not sure, and had a one-bedroom apartment attached to it, and my classroom was built some years after that, and it was just a one classroom, and in the village there was no running water, no electricity, no sewer, no TV, and the only radio that people got is it came in at night if they strung a wire out their window or out their house and stretched it over to a tree not too far away. And then they'd make a little coil out of the end of the wire and attach that to something going down in the ground. And that would amplify the radio signal so they could actually hear Bethel, Anchorage stations. They could get KJNP from up near Fairbanks. So that was about all they had for incoming entertainment, if you will. We did have a radio in the school that we could communicate with schools up and down the river. It was an HF radio. It was a big northern radio. Some of you older folks out there might remember them. It's about probably a 30-inch, 30, maybe a 3-foot tall big radio full of tubes in it. But it did actually travel a long way, so that was really pretty good. And but growing up in Southern California, in the LA area where there was millions of people, big schools, lots of parks and beaches, and warm weather, it seemed like all year round. It certainly was a different life for Mary Lou and I living up in the Arctic of Alaska, where it's cold and the nights are very dark, or very long, I should say, compared to what it is down there. I thought it would be interesting to share with you that we weren't there too long. Still in that first year, we noticed other teachers would come and go, and they had airplanes. There are no roads, of course, in Sleep Mute all through the interior. And they would say, we're going to Anchorage for the weekend, and we'll maybe see you on Sunday when we come back through, dump a couple cans of gas in their plane. And that seemed pretty good. And the only travel in our area, other than your boat or snowmobile in the villages real close to you, was by airplane. And quite a few people in Alaska, we began to notice, have airplanes. So I remember it wasn't long, maybe into January, and one time I told Mary Lou, I said, Mary Lou, you know what we need? She says, what's that? And I says, an airplane. She goes, well, yeah, I was thinking the same thing. So that did it. We began to look for an airplane. I radioed on the radio my friends and told them we were going to look to buy an airplane. Well, let's just turn the guy in our village. He had an air taxi, and he had two airplanes. One was a Super Cub, a two-seat Super Cub. The other was like a Super Cub. It was a Piper, but it was a four-seat Cub called a PA-14 family cruiser. Some of you may know what that is. And he said, well, why don't you buy my PA-14? And I said, well, I don't know. And I talked to people up and down the river, and they said, oh, yeah, there's not many 14s because they're a four-seater. There are not many around, and if you don't want it, we'll take it. And so we decided, told Nixie we would take it, and he says, but I thought you didn't know how to fly. And I said, well, I haven't crossed that bridge yet. He said, well, if you buy it, he said, I know a guy down in Bethel, a friend of mine, and he's a flight instructor, and he flies for an air taxi down there, and he also owns a barber shop in Bethel. His name is Vern Hurlbert, and if any of you have ever been through the Anchorage airport and noticed the little barber shop right before you go in to the TSA, before you board the Flagstar Airlines, he still runs that barber shop there, and he's getting to be even an older timer than me, but he still worked there and works that barber shop. Well, anyway, It was about the first week in February. One day he showed up in Sleep Mute, and Nixie had called him, and he caught a ride about 80 miles from Bethel up to Antioch. And next he says, take Richard Wilmarth, a friend from Red Devil, the next place, village down, he said, and you guys jump in that P-14, go down and pick up Vern and bring him back, and he can give you some lessons. And I thought, well, great, well, we can do that. So that evening, that afternoon and evening, we flew down to Antioch, and Richard was a good pilot. He was a commercial pilot, not much of an instructor. He says, well, get in, let's go, you fly it. And I said, what do I do? I don't know what to do. And he says, well, start it up. And I didn't know the first thing about him. The next thing, he had me taxiing out on skis, on the ice, to take off. And he says, okay, give her the power. And so I'm giving it the power, and we're going left and right. And he says, keep it straight, keep it straight. I'm trying to keep it straight, but with zero experience, I was barely making it. Well, anyway, we got airborne, and within the hour, we got down to Antioch. And he says, okay, slow her down and land her. And I says, okay, how do I do that? And he says, well, pull your power back. And I did that. And anyway, finally got her headed toward the runway. And down we came a little bit by little. And he says, keep it lined up with the runway. I says, I'm trying. And it's going, I'm overreacting to the left, to the right, to the left, to the right, and kind of get it back. But each time coming back over the runway, finally got down over the runway. And apparently I chopped the power a little too much, too soon, and I was still probably about 4 or 5 feet high, and the plane just kind of dropped. It was flat, but it bounced pretty hard, and it came up in the air, bounced again, bounced about 3 times before it finally settled on the runway. And then Vern goes, okay, pull off over there. There's the house where Vern will be at, and that would be Buster Vanderpool's house. He had a family with a bunch of kids, and we pulled in there, and one of the teenage girls ran out, and she says, who was flying that airplane? And Richard said, oh, that was Vince flying. Like, that's the way I always fly. That was my first landing ever. But so Vern got in with us, and we flew back to Sleep Mute. And he was a very good instructor. He just told me everything to do, how to do it, and why we were doing it. And took the next 2 days off school, half days. I had to teach at least a half day to make it a day. And then it was on the second day, Vern said, we need to get your student pilot's license and get you a logbook out, and we need to do a cross country. So let's do a cross country back to Bethel. So that next day we flew back to Bethel, spent the night, got my pilot's license in the morning, or my pilot's medical in the morning, and jumped in the plane. Then we flew on the way home, went over to the Yukon. We landed at the village of Russian Mission. There was this two-teacher school there as well, kind of up on the hill, and went up and saw the teachers. Vern was talked to him about flying a plane back up from Oregon for him. He had bought a Cub, but it was still down in Oregon. Then the next stop was back over to the Kuskokwim. We stopped at Kalskag, which is pretty much on the way home, just before you get to Antioch. And we went in and traded a bunch of traps for snare material to Sam Parent. He owned the store there in Kalskag. And because Nixie was out of beaver snare material, February's beaver season open, and so we made that trade for him and got back up to Sleep Mute there around noon. Well, it seemed like a lot had already happened that day, but we walked in, we landed on the ice out there, of course, and went up to the house where Nixie, the guy I'm buying the airplane, was, and he also had the store. And my instructor, Vern, goes, he says, well, Vince is ready to solo. And Nixie looks at him and he says, solo? He's only been flying 3 days. And Vern says, no, he's ready. He's got landings down really well. And Nixie says, well, why don't you do one more cross country? Take it into Anchorage, put it in his name, and then if he wrecks it, it's his. So we chuckled about that, but probably some truth to that. So I said, well, I've got to go talk to Mary Lil. My wife had been gone since yesterday. I need to see her. And so I talked to her and told her that they're thinking about going into Anchorage. It's another 2.5 hour flight just to get into Anchorage through the Alaska Range, through Merrill Pass. And I had been that way only once with Nixie prior to that. Never flown right through, but so Mariel said, well, maybe if you got a chance to buy the plane and get it in our name and do the bank work, we should go for it. So that's what we did. We flew in through Merrill Pass, bought the airplane, put it in our name, and we came back out the next day, and I still had not soloed. And then Vern, since it was about noon, Vern says, how about flying me down to Bethel? I got to get home. And I said, Vern, I haven't even soloed yet. And he said, that can be your first solo, a flight cross-country 180 miles from Bethel to Sleep Mute. And so it was. That was my first solo. It's not the normal way that most people get the pilot's license, but it's what was available and what worked. And so having our own airplane, I kept it out on the river like where it had been on skis. And we would normally pull it up on a couple birch poles or something to get the skis so they didn't freeze down in the ice. And that made it easier to pull off when it was time. But I'd go out after school for an hour, hour and a half, and I would just fly it up and down the river and do like Vern had taught me to. He'd taught me to get good control of the airplane by flying it 10 feet high and follow the snow machine trails on the river and make the turns that the snow machine made. So that sharpened up my control of the airplane a little bit. And I remember about a week later, I decided to fly down to Red Devil. That was the next village downriver from us, and John Murphy was the school teacher down there, and he was married to the guy I bought the airplanes from, Nixie's sister, and her name was Catherine. And so Nixie's mom, who lived with him at Sleep Mute, had gone down that same day in she rode in the back of in a dog sled behind a snowmobile. And I was visiting John, and her name was Nani, the elderly lady, and she walks in, she goes, oh, Vince, you're here. How you get here? And I says, well, Nani, I flew the plane down. She says, oh, good, I ride home with you. And I said, oh, sorry, Nani. I said, I can't take you. I don't have a pilot's license. And she says, oh, that's okay. And I said, no, it's not okay. I can't take you. She says, I watch you fly. You good pilot. And I says, well, thank you, Nani, but that's not it. I have to have a license first. She says, okay. So I continued my visit for another hour or so with John, the teacher, and I told him, well, sun's getting low. I better be heading back. And so I walked out on the river, opened the door to the airplane, and Nani is sitting in the back of the airplane. And I says, Nani, sorry, I cannot take you. She says, you have to. Snowmobile already go ahead of me. And I said, I finally thought, well, I guess so. So I took her back, landed in front of her house, then took off again and landed in front of the school, and all was well. Not the way you're supposed to do it, but sometimes that's what you have to do. And anyway, I just kind of looking at a couple things I jotted down to tell you. Didn't mean to make that story so long, but I just thought you might kind of enjoy how I got started flying. And I can just tell you that we had the plane through that. We put it on wheels out on the ice. For the first time, I took off on wheels. And then I had to go land on a runway, and I didn't have any brakes on it yet, but we made it okay. And then I put brakes on it, that summer we we decided to go out and see our folks and family down in California where we had come from. So we jumped in the airplane, we flew it through Merrill Pass into Anchorage, and I rented a tie down spot at Merrill Field. And we caught a taxi cab ride over to Anchorage International and flew home on Western Airlines all the way to Los Angeles, where our folks picked us up. And then I found a flight school down at Long Beach, California, close about 10, 15 minutes from where my mom and dad lived. And I went down and rented a little airplane and told them that's what I'd like to finish my pilot's license in. And the lady who ran the flight school, she says, do you have a logbook? I said, yeah. And she says, let me see it. And I show her my logbook. She says, let me get this straight. I know a little bit about flying in Alaska. She says, I've been up there. But she says, you flew from Sleipmute to Nome and back in the middle of winter. And I said, yeah, I did. And that would have been on my student license when I only had about 30 hours or 25. And she says, and then you flew, you went caribou hunting in your airplane, it looks like you put here, and then you flew through Merrill Pass into Anchorage. You did all this on a student license? And I said, yes. And she says, I want to fly with you. And so all of the young guys who were her flight instructors were kind of looking big-eyed at me, wondering, could I have really done all that on a student license? And I never got any more instruction. Vern was always going to come back and give me more, but he just never made it up. But so we went out and we rented a little plane and we flew around. She made me do turns and climbs and stalls and all those things you do when you fly an airplane. And that was all fine. But coming back into the airport, you have to talk to the tower people and make the right procedures and turns and right airplane patterns and so forth. But we made it and got down. So one of the guys says, well, how did Vince do? How was his flying? She says, his flying is fine. She says, but his radio work is atrocious. So with that, I got a few more lessons and got enough to finish up my license and actually learn to talk on the radio as well. So when we got back up to Alaska toward latter, after being down there a couple months that summer, we got in our little airplane, and I was now legal to haul passengers, and we flew back out to Merrill Pass and started our second year. And this year, with that year, we started with a pilot's license. And of course, it wasn't long. The first weekend in September, moose season opens, and so now we've got an airplane to hunt with, and that made it pretty easy just to fly around and spot moose. There were moose everywhere. The limit was 2 bulls back then. And so one evening there, I think it was a Thursday afternoon, I asked our custodian, Arthur Andrianoff. I said, Arthur, you want to jump in the airplane? Let's go up and see if we can get us a moose. And we thought it'd be pretty easy just to fly up river, up the whole Lytton ways, and land on a gravel bar somewhere close to a moose, shoot him, and get him cut up, and maybe bring some moose meat home with us, and then the next day go get the rest of it. And so away we went, but it turned out not such an easy moose hunt. You'll like this, but here's what happened. We flew up the river, and every time we saw a nice big bull, he was a little bit too far away from the river, further than we wanted to pack it anyway. And we were trying to get one real close by. So we passed up the first several, and finally, coming up, we come around a bend, and there was a nice-sized bull, a nice, pretty nice rack, standing by 2 cows. And they were just down probably 200 yards around this bend, and on the bend was a gravel bar I could use for a runway. So I thought, oh, this is perfect. This is going to be easy. So we landed on the gravel bar, walked around the corner of the gravel bar, and sure enough, there was the big bull moose standing there close to those 2 cows, and I took aim, fired, and missed. Took aim, fired, missed again. So I said, I don't know what's wrong. I ran up a little ways where there was a tree to use for a rest, shot, missed again. The bull had run a little ways, but he kept coming back to those cows. I shot, must be 5 or 6 times, and I thought, well, man, there's something way wrong. And I thought, maybe I'll try shooting high in case the bullet's going low. That didn't work. And then I tried shooting under his belly in case the bullet was high. That didn't work. So I said, I got to get closer, Arthur. So I ran up about half that distance, and he was still hadn't moved much. And I shot from a downed tree that was on the gravel bar, and I still couldn't hit him. I shot 2 or 3 more times, and that time he ran away from me. He and the cows ran away from me along the side of the riverbank, on the flat by the water, and they ran up. They finally, I shot a few more times at them, not hitting them, and they went, as they went up the bank, about a 10-foot-high bank, onto the flat top, I thought perhaps I might have got him. It looked like he stumbled. So I said, I'm going to go up there, Arthur, and check him. I ran down there, went right up the same trail they went up, and I couldn't see anything, but I listened, and he kept calling. I don't know if he was calling the cows, but he was making that typical bull sound, kind of, mah, mah. And I thought, oh, there he is over there. So I went that way. I got within probably about 50 yards of him or so, and I thought, this is surely enough to hit him, and I looked through my scope and put it right in the middle of his chest. Nothing. I'd fire away and he'd run away. And I'd chase after him, I'd keep locating. Well, pretty soon that bull moose made a big full circle, and he came down on the river right where, almost where my airplane was, pretty close between there and where I first shot at him. And then he turned back the way toward where I first saw him. And then Arthur's yelling at me just as I approach the river. And he goes, hey, here he comes. I got no gun. And Arthur was afraid that bull moose was going to charge him. So Arthur ran and got behind a tree stump right when that bull moose went by. But the moose raced right by him. And he was not interested in Arthur. He was just interested in getting away, fortunately. So as he got there, I fired a couple more shots. I only started with one box of shells, and I was getting low. And so the moose got there, and he went right up the bank, the same exact spot where he went up the first time. He had made a big circle, probably like a quarter mile run around a track. And I ran down there, and I ran behind him, and I listened to him, and I had two shells left out of a box of 20. And pretty soon, I thought, you know, I can't get my scope off. I tried to get it off. I didn't have a screwdriver, a dime to turn the screw. So I'm just going to look down the side of my barrel, not on the sights, and point at him. I think I'm close enough to hit him. So I fired once, and I knew I hit him. I heard the hit, and I heard him limp, and he kind of ran off. And I still had one more shell. And as he was kind of going away from me, I thought, I think I can knock him down doing the same thing. So I fired my last shot, and the moose, and I pretty soon I went up to him, and the moose was down. He was lying down, but not with his head up, but not, his head was not laying down on the ground like he was going to die. So I walked up to him, and the moose was just laying down looking at me, and I was saying, go on, get up and run, go on. But he wouldn't, the moose didn't move, he was staying down. So I thought, if I could get him up to run, I think he would bleed out faster and die, because I knew he was hit. So I picked up a piece of wood, probably about the size of a baseball bat, and I gave it a fling, and it hit the moose right in the ribs. And the moose jumped up and came charging right at me. And before I, and at that very moment, I just threw my gun and ran as fast as I could, and that bull moose was right behind me for a ways. But I kept running through the willows, hoping I wouldn't fall down, because I knew if I fell down, he would trample me. But I made it through the willows until I was hundred yards away or so, away. And then I was thinking, where's my gun? I got to find my gun, and even though I had no shells for it. But I worked the big circle back. I found my gun where I had dropped it. And then I listened, and the moose was... I heard him grunt again. So I went that way and I saw him, but as soon as he saw me, it was about 40 yards this time, he got up and ran at me again, but I was far enough away to hang on to my gun and run away from him. And finally, it was almost getting dark, and Arthur's yelling, hey, it's getting dark. And so I went toward the beach and joined Arthur. We got in the airplane, and it was just almost dark when we took off. And we got back to Sleep Mute, and I hated to leave a wounded moose out there, but I had no choice. And to mark the spot, I pulled off my t-shirt and tied it on a big, long branch that hung out over the river to mark the spot. I could see that white t-shirt the next day, because it seemed like all those bends looked alike. But I went back with Mary Lil the next day, took my scope off, and my iron sights were right on. So we landed, went up there, and walked down to where that moose was. He was still alive, fortunately, although he didn't get up. The reason he didn't get up this time, he had a broken leg. I didn't realize that until later, but he was actually getting up chasing me with a front broken leg. And but this time I put one shot in his head and put him out of his misery. And so Mary Lil helped me butcher the moose. We had only, a deer was the biggest thing we had ever done in Montana, but that moose was so big. And we packed the meat only a little ways to the river. And this time I had brought my little yellow lifeboat instead of packing it all the way back to the airplane gravel bar, which is almost a quarter of a mile away. I thought, we'll just put it in the boat, float down to the next gravel bar, and we won't have to pack it. So Mary Lil was going to, so I put her in the boat, and I loaded all those big pieces of meat and the antlers in the boat, and she set sail floating, drifting down the river. And I went back to the airplane, and I said, meet me at the next gravel bar. I'll be on the next gravel bar you come to. So I went and I landed, and here she came around the bend. And I said, row, get over on this side. She was rowing as hard as she could, but the current was too fast, and it was taking her right on by. She couldn't get over. So I said, meet me at the next one. So I got in the airplane and took off and passed her. Landed on the next gravel bar. It was kind of an island out in the middle. And fortunately, she looks like she was going to make it over, but she finally jumped out with chest waders on, and the water was right up almost to the top of her chest waders. But we got the boat ashore, got it in, and then we loaded up the plane with as much meat as I could get into it to get off of that gravel bar. And we left the rest, covered it up with a tarp to come back and get the next morning, which is what we did. Well, I apologize for making that story so long. Sometimes it seems like I just get to remembering things and talking away, and next thing I know I've talked way more than I should. But I do want to move on and tell you kind of about our next major adventure, which is how we got to Alaska. This in itself is a truly amazing story. And behind it is that God himself wanted us in Alaska, and I'll tell you why in just a moment here, but he not only wanted us in Alaska, he wanted us in particular at Sleet Mute, Alaska. And we were, as I told you, may have told you, I grew up in California, both Mary Lil and I, in the Los Angeles area, and Long Beach, California. And it was a good childhood. California was a good place to grow up in many respects. The weather was always nice. There was lots of parks and beaches, plenty of things to do, and schools. There was lots of kids. And I grew up, my dad taking me hunting, taking me fishing. We went on hunting or on camping trips and hiking trips. And those are the things I just grew up really enjoying. And but I was not thinking of God in any of that. I was not giving God credit for making the beautiful mountains and the ocean and all the game that I used to like to catch and fish that I love to catch. And that being said, when I was in college, some of my friends, we found ourselves just kind of doing things for excitement. We were drinking beer on weekends, drinking too much, and just living to please ourselves, kind of always looking for another party or something fun to do. And God knew that I was probably not going to find him if I kept hanging out with that crowd doing what I was doing. So God put it on my heart to to move north, to move to some little small town, because every time we went on a outing, it seemed like we would drive for hours to get someplace in the mountains or some lake where we could go camping for a night or two, and then hours long drive home. And I thought, some people, you know, they live right there where they can just go a few minutes from their home. They don't have to do all them long trips like that. And so as I was thinking of those things, I met a wonderful young lady, Mary Lil. I met my wife, and she was not only pretty, she was very friendly. In fact, in her high school class, they voted her the friendliest girl in the whole school. And so, but everywhere we went, we had fun, and she was willing to go anywhere that I wanted to go. So we got married in summer of 1970, and we knew that shortly after that we would move someplace up north. I didn't know where, but I knew that's what we wanted to do. Well, it turns out that was God starting us on our journey to Sleep Mute. The first step took us to Bozeman, Montana. My best friend, and I was in his wedding, and he was in my wedding, and he moved to Bozeman, Montana. He got a teaching position there at the university and earning his master's degree, invited us to come stay with him while we looked for a job. And I was a PE major, a physical education gym teacher, and there weren't any jobs available, let alone to out-of-staters, Californians like we were. But we moved up there anyway, figuring I'll find a job doing something, and we did. And then so God took the very next step. Though I found a construction job, I was working every day. One afternoon, I was walking down the halls of the university, just in fact across the street from where I was working, and I noticed a poster on the board, and it said Alaska State Operated School District is there was a federal program anyway to retrain teachers that had a degree in anything except elementary ed to apply for this program, and you could go to school for 1 year and earn an elementary teaching certificate. And you started by going that summer, and then that fall you had to go up to a little town of White Sulphur Springs, Montana, and they were going to be six people selected for the program, and we would teach in that school with the teachers that are there. And plus, we would get college credits for all of our teaching and going to school. All our classes and books were paid for. And they even paid me a living allowance, like I was getting paid for our apartment to live on. So that seemed like a win-win situation for us. So I applied for it. And lo and behold, Mary Lil and I both took elementary ed classes all summer. She hadn't graduated yet, but was getting close to her degree. And in the fall, we moved up to White Sulphur Springs, where I had credit for all the classes I took, and I taught in three different grades during the year. And toward the end of the year, they offered me a teaching job to stay in that town. The only problem with it was Mary Lil was only a few classes away in the summer from having her teaching degree, and there was no second job available for her. So I told Marilla, we need to be looking for a town where there's two jobs available. And Marilla said, yeah, that sounds good. So shortly after that, one of the other teachers came to me, young teachers, and he says, hey, Vince, are you going to go interview with Alaska State Operated Schools? And I said, what's that? He says, on the poster, the one on the poster downstairs. I said, what poster? He says, the big poster right there by on the wall where you come in the teacher's lounge. And I says, oh, I don't go in the teacher's lounge. He says, what do you mean you don't go in the teacher's lounge? And I said, well, that's where all those old ladies smoke cigarettes down there, and I don't like hanging out down there. So He says, "Oh, well, you better take a look at that poster if you want to see what there's a lot of, there's apparently jobs in Alaska." So I went down. I'm watching a sea lion out my window here as we speak. But we heard that they were coming over to Helena, which is our capital, on St. Patrick's Day. And so I called them to see if we could get an appointment. But they told us that when I called that they were already out touring Western United States, all the major cities, to interview for Teachers for Alaska. And it was too late to get an interview or get an appointment, but they would take walk-ins. So Mary Lowell and I took off on that afternoon, drove about an hour and a half over to Helena, Montana, and found the motel where they were supposed to be. And we walked in and said, "Yeah, we would like to talk to you about getting a job." And the girl they had hired said, "Well, we can take you, but we started at 11 this morning, and we don't have any openings for appointments until 11:15 tonight, and they're cranking through them, doing each of the two guys are doing 2 an hour every 15 minutes." And so I said, "Well, I don't guess we want to stay for that." And he said, "Why don't you take an application and then drop it off by, go and take your wife out to dinner while you're here?" And that's what I had told Mary Lowell I would do in the first place. So we did that and went and watched a movie, and we dropped the applications back by. And the guy interviewing us said, "Oh, you're in luck." He said, "I just got a cancellation. And if you and Mary Lowell want to share an interview, I can interview you next." And we said, "Sure." So that was God taking care of that issue. We interviewed, and the guy liked us. He showed me some pictures of some big moose he shot and some big salmon, and it all looked pretty good. And he said, "You'll hear from us in a month. And we'll, because all the teachers, we have to know where our teachers are going to be switching to." And there are all the schools across the whole state, from the Aleutians to the North Slope to the logging towns in southeast to all the interior villages. There's, I'd seem like 1,000-some teachers. But anyway, a month went by, and we didn't hear anything. So I told Mary, I called them up, and they said, "No, we don't have any openings." Some lady didn't sound very positive. So Mary Lowell and I started traveling each weekend in Montana to find us some jobs. And sure enough, we found some jobs in a nice little town up close to Yellowstone Park, and figured, well, it's a done deal. That's where we're going. We're not going to Alaska. And so when school was out that summer, we had one more move before we went to teach, and that was back to Bozeman so Mary Lowell could take a few more classes to finish her degree. And I got a job lifeguarding at the swimming pool. And then one afternoon, in God's providence, a Western Union truck, some of you probably never heard of Western Union or telegrams, unless you're an old guy like me, but a guy pulled up and he says, "Are you, I'm looking for Vince Spady. I have a telegram for him." And I said, "I'm Vince Spady." And so he gave me the telegram, and they sent us a telegram because they could, because Alaska State Operating Schools could not get a hold of us in through the mail, because we were house sitting someone else's house, and we had not re-registered, changed the address with the post office, our old post office, and we were using their phone, so we didn't have our own phone number. And so they had tried to get a hold of us but had given up. But finally, this one superintendent out near Sleep Mute needed teachers for Sleep Mute. He said, "I'm going to try one more time," and sent the telegram. And lo and behold, I read it, and it said, "Offered to teach school at Sleep Mute, Alaska. Vince told what grades, Mary Lowell what grades." And I went in excitedly, and when Mary Lowell got home from class, I showed her, "Look here, Mary Lowell, we got offers to go to Alaska. Pays over twice what Montana does." She said, "Well, that would be great, except for we've already signed contracts. We already have jobs." And I said, "Well, he'd let us out of them." And she says, "When you sign a contract, you honor it." And I knew she was right, but it was just hard for me to quit thinking about Alaska. So, and Mary Lowell wasn't willing to do any more. She said, "Well, maybe next year." And I said, "Okay." And But the very next day, Mariel gets out of class and is driving to the shopping center, and a car with an Alaska license plate passes her in front of her and gets in her lane and is right in front of her. And Mariel, driving along, is shaking her head going, "No, that's not a sign." And so, but anyway, that car puts on a blinker, turns into the parking lot where she's going to go shopping. And she gets out, and a young couple gets out, and she says, "Excuse me, I see you have Alaska plates on your car. Are you from up in Alaska?" And they go, "Yeah, we are." And she says, "Well, my husband and I were just offered some teaching contracts up there." And they go, "Well, where at?" She said, "Oh, it's a little village way out in the middle of nowhere. It's called Sleetmute." And they go, "Oh, you're the couple that's going to replace Dave and Jill. They're going to Northway, and so you guys are going to be the new teachers there." And Mary said, "Well, I don't know about that," but she spent an hour talking with them. They told her how fun it was, how you put everything on that you want to take. You take it over to the barge, Pier 91 in Seattle, and put it on a barge, and it'll get transferred at Bethel to go up the river, and how you can order a year's supply of staples to be delivered by barge to your store, and how the kids are, and how much fun it was. She came home all excited to go to Alaska. So we talked to the other superintendent. He said, "Well, I hate to lose you, but it's still only June, so you guys go ahead, and I'd rather you be happy up there than unhappy here." So that's what we did. And then once we got to Sleetmute, that was really the perfect place, because Sleetmute was 8 miles from a kid's Bible, summer Bible camp. And the Christian people that came in that next spring and summer, all these Christian counselors and cooks and nurses and all those people, we met them all, and they were real friendly and loving to us. And right after we started school that first year, a plane flew in one day and landed, and a man and his daughter got out of the plane and came over, and they asked if they could do a good news club and use my classroom. And I said, "When do you want to do this?" Or they said after school. And I said, "Well, if you do it after school, I think all the kids leave. They all like jumping in their moms and dads' boats and going up river to the store or going out to shoot ducks and stuff. So I don't think many are going to come." I said, "Why don't you do it during, like, at 2 o'clock or during the school day, and then they'll all be there." He said, "Really?" I said, "Sure, why not?" So that was they did that. It was kind of like Sunday school, but that's the first time I ever heard the true gospel of who Jesus was and what he did for us. And so, although I didn't just instantly run open my Bible and become a Christian, that planted a seed in me. And then the following summer, a missionary from Fairbanks who wanted to start doing missionary work out in our area, who had lived here 20 years before down in Antioch, he came out there, and his pilot dropped him off at Sleetmute, and that's where he wanted to spend 6 weeks, going up and down the river telling the people about the Lord and talking to them, and then going home and being with his wife for 6 weeks. And she wasn't in good enough health, or she would have come with him. But and so the first person he stayed with was us, and we ended up eventually calling him Jim Who Walks With God, because he was always had a God story, and he trusted the Lord for everything. And well, to shorten this up, kind of land this plane, so to speak, we continued to help out with the camp. In fact, I was flying kids into camp just to help out, because it was a good thing. But even though we had a Bible we had gotten for a wedding present, I had never read it. And it wasn't until starting our fourth year there, I actually got a pilot's flying job, because the pilot who flew for the air taxi went to work up on the pipeline construction, oil pipeline, and it left an opening there, so I took that job. And and it wasn't until I would read it at night under a Coleman light, I opened that Bible, and for some reason, I guess the Holy Spirit told me to start reading at the book of John. Well, I began reading the Gospel of John, and I found out John is a very personable guy. He really tells you his life story and whatnot. And as I read that book, it took me only 3 nights to read through the whole book of John, all those chapters. And it was very clear who God was, and God was speaking to me what I need to do to give thanks to God and become part of the kingdom of God myself. And so that's when I told God, I said, God, I'm sorry. I said, all these years, I felt like I was an old man. I was 29 or 28 by then, I guess. But I said, I've never knew who you were. And I believe, and I told him, I'll go anywhere you want or do anything you want me to do. And not that I've done everything perfect or done everything he wants me to do, but life has been way, way better, much more meaningful, more exciting, much more purpose than it ever was when I was living my life for myself without God in it. And I just wanted to maybe close this up, at least for now. One verse that just always kind of stuck with me and maybe means something to you too, but this particular verse is in Psalm chapter 51, and I'm going to read it to you. Actually, he says, create in me a clean heart, O God. Renew a loyal spirit within me. Do not banish me from your presence, and don't take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation, and make me willing to obey you. Then I will teach your ways to rebels, and they will return to you. And that's just always been kind of strong on my heart. And all the times, I could go on with many more stories if I had time, which I don't, and tell you how God has saved me from a disaster one way or another. And one time my plane was on fire. Another time Mary Lou and I went down in the mountains. Another time our engine quit, and we went down in the mud on the Yukon. But this verse holds true for this. And it is Psalm 50, verse 15. He says, then call on me when you are in trouble, and I will rescue you, and you will give me glory. So I called on him that time when my plane was on fire at 7,000 feet, and he rescued me. Praise the Lord. I'm going to stop for now, and thank you all for listening.
That has been Vince Spady. I'm so thankful he was able to share some of those stories and verses. Wasn't that good? We were talking, and I was like, his voice is made for radio. It's so good. And I hope that you are blessed. You can email me if you'd like to send him an encouraging note at mathewroman@gmail.com. This has been Pastor Matthew, Hour of Hope, and we have had a very special guest, Vince Spady. Have a good day. Remember, there's always hope in Jesus Christ. Bye. You will